Pat McCauley, and I'm interviewing Stan Weir. We're at Stan's house in San Pedro. It's November 3rd, 1990. Stan, can you start out telling us something about where you were born and who your parents were?
I was born in Los Angeles. The family was living on the east side in what's now East Los Angeles, in an unincorporated area. And we moved into the city limits for a couple of years when I was an infant, into Boyle Heights, just off Brooklyn Avenue. And then we moved back to the house my great-grandfather and grandfather had built on Alma Street. It used to be called Doris Avenue, one block outside the city limits between Whittier Boulevard and Olympic Boulevard. They were from, on my mother's side, they were all of English extraction and had come to this country via Canada. And my mother and her two brothers, Stan and George, and my grandmother, Elizabeth Hoggard, and William Hoggard, H-O-G-G-A-R-D, came 1909, I guess it was, yes. When my mother was born in 1898, she was 11. And my great-grandfather had already been out here and had built one of the houses on this piece of, this double lot that he had.
It was on Elm Street?
Alma.
Alma?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And my father had left. My mother and father had separated when I was very young, maybe when I was 2 weeks to 2 months old, somewhere in there. And my father's side of the family was of almost no influence on me. That is, I never lived under the same roof with my father or any of his people.
Did his family live in the same area of LA?
No, they lived in Laverne and Orange Grove country, east of Los Angeles, about 20 miles. I've forgotten the name of the other town, starts with an M, and next to Laverne. And my father his job at that time was fumigating orange trees, setting up smudge pots, irrigation, and also driving a lumber truck.
Did you... So when you were young, then, you lived with your mother and her...
My mother, my grandmother, and my Uncle Stan.
Your Uncle Stan. Mm-hmm. And did you see your father at times?
I saw him when he was two, for the first time that I remember. And I didn't see him again until I was 17 or 18. Well, I was 18. I was in a blister rust camp in Northern California near Sonora. And I just had the urge to see him. And I came down. His mother was in a Women's Christian Temperance Union home in Eagle Rock, California. She was 80-some. And I pressured her into telling him his identity. He had changed his name in order to avoid paying
child support.
And so she finally revealed what it was. Me. She was very nice, a very sweet woman. And I went to see him. And, he was living in Napa. He had an appliance store, fair-sized appliance store. And I stayed with him only very briefly. I was going to stay 3 days. I think I stayed one or two. He bored me.
Mm-hmm. Was he afraid or when he saw you? Are you told him who you were?
Oh, yeah, he knew. I mean, he was up in above St. Helena at his in-law's big orchard and grape ranch. And he drove down to Napa, and we had dinner together, and drove back up there, an immense old redwood, magnificent Victorian redwood home with a porch all the way around. And I found myself talking to his stepfather. He was on his his father-in-law. He was on his third marriage and third child. He had a daughter by a second wife and his daughter by the third wife. And I liked that little girl. She was a little three-year-old blonde girl. But I left. And I saw him a couple of more times during the war. Once Mary was with me, I think. And we didn't get along. When I came in early in the war, and I had been in maritime apprentice seaman training program, and I had applied for cadet corps. I had applied for that first. It's the only way I knew to go to sea. There was an office downtown, an ad in the paper. And I showed up at his place during a big barbecue. And he wanted so bad to introduce me as his son. There's all the patriotism, and here's a kid in uniform and all that, a gold braider. And he couldn't. He had a different name. And it was killing him. And I got a little bit of perverse satisfaction from that.
So, building up, was your Uncle Stan, your father's figure? What did you say?
Not really. He was more like an older brother. Sort of a prodigal older brother. He was came into the workforce in the prosperity days. I think he was 17 when I was born. And God, you could get jobs anywhere. And he was a good-looking young guy, and he was strong, and he was a good fighter and all that, and a good dancer. And he was an extra in musicals, in early Hollywood musicals. And when the Depression hit, when the crash hit, and he became unemployed, he had been moving about so much that he was not prepared with any skills. And it really demoralized him, and he didn't work really from 1930 until about 1930, for about 7 or 8 years, he was hardcore unemployed and doing a lot of heavy drinking. Made his own beer and at home and drink green beer all day long, day after day after day.
Did you ever drink any of that green beer?
Yes. I'd bring guys home from school, and one day I came home in the middle of the summer afternoon, bang, bang. And I thought the kid with the .22 down the block was shooting at us. And I was on the back screen porch. It was the heat of the sun on the side of the house against the beer bottles, green beer, and they were blowing their bottle caps into my grandmother's big wash tub that was sitting on its side. But it was a pretty good beer.
You don't remember what kind of job Stan had, huh?
He had Hollywood jobs, as I mentioned. He had an office job at Libby McNeil and Libby, a big canner, food, all kinds of canned food, canned fruit,
Libby's
vegetables and so on. Libby's was a big outfit. I remember he would come home Christmases with his pockets full of ring cases with $20 gold pieces in the ring cases. That was the big thing then. And people were very affluent at that time.
How would gold pieces?
Yeah, $20 gold piece in the place, instead of a ring, in a ring case.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. That's what he gave as present.
That was what he was given as present.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Did your mom work?
Yeah, she... She got a job before she met my father working at a telephone company. And after I was old enough to leave with my grandmother, she got a job as a domestic, in the garment district. She apprenticed in 1914. 50 cents a week downtown L.A. in Feltz. But the girl she worked with started at the same time got consumption and lung disease from felt dust, and she quit when that girl died. But she got a job as a dressmaker for the wife of the president of RKO, who then became the president of Paramount Pictures, the man who brought Mae West out to the coast, W.C. Fields, Leon Errol, Bing Crosby, and others. And he was a star maker. He wrote the book for the operetta Apple Blossom Time with Deems Taylor, William LeBaron did. And he was divorced or separated from his wife, Mabel LeBaron. She was a Florida girl, Ezekiel. And she had an immense house on Hudson Avenue near Vine Street when it was the real rich, with a big swimming pool, Olympic-sized swimming pool, a tennis court, two tennis courts. She had a bar, imported a whole bar, all its furnishings from Holland in the basement, and a moving picture theater in the basement.
Was working for her?
She was a private dressmaker. And the woman had two housekeepers, a masseuse, her own masseuse, full-time, living on, a Danish masseuse, two cooks, two chauffeurs, a gardener, and the two apartments over the garage each had a young man in there for her.
It sounds like the place on in that movie Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah. It was like that, only this woman was not a big star like Gloria Swanson was portraying in Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, it is a great movie. Did you get to go up to this house?
Oh, yeah. It was where I first realized that there were really rich people in the world. And mainly it was the thing that symbolized it was the cigarettes. My uncle was home, Stan and George both, rolling their own Bull Durham. And I would go out there and I saw all these tailor-mades and I stuffed my pockets with packages of tailor-mades. I went home looking 10 pounds heavier. And my uncle didn't get angry at me for bringing home those cigarettes either. But then I came home with a gold cigarette lighter the next time. They had them laying around, real gold cigarette lighters, laying around on all these tables. And I brought about five packages of flat 50s. They put 50 cigarettes in a tin, a fancy tin that opened like a cigarette case. They were called flat 50s. Lucky Strike was big on them, but they all made it. And I brought home this gold cigarette lighter, and he said, "Hold it. That's enough. Got to stop none of that." And he made me take it back, put it back. But it really impressed me, the wealth that this woman had. And I didn't show anger at it, but I felt. And one of the things happened, like, I would take the R car from East L.A. to the end of the R car line at Larchmont, and then my mother would have the chauffeurs go down and pick me up. Because my mother and I would do a lot of hiking. We were hiking up the Mount Wilson at night, at Camp Orchard, 3.5 miles up. We'd get the red car, Sierra Madre, at the foot of Mount Wilson, and hike up 3.5 miles, and there's Camp Orchard, and stay overnight. We'd hike the next day, and stay overnight and come down Sunday morning. And this day I got off on Vermont Avenue. I was about 8 or 9. And I walked up to the top of Vermont past Hollywood Boulevard where W.C. Fields picked me up in his Rolls Royce and took me to LeBaron's house because he had an appointment there with Mr. LeBaron, who was using that as a hideaway for conferences. And I saw that Rolls Royce, and I saw the big bar in there in the back of this Rolls Royce, and that impressed me a great deal.
I'm surprised. I thought, well, W.C. Fields hated kids. Did you get
that? I didn't get that. I got that. He was extremely nice to me, as I recall. And he even gave me his autograph, which I gave to a W.C. Fields buff in Illinois.
That's interesting. Well, in the neighborhood where you live, so go back to your years in Buchanan, and what was the neighborhood like? You're walking down the street.
They were all single-family dwelling units, and there were only, I think, two stuccos in the whole block that had been built in the 20s or around the World War I era. Most of these houses had been built between 1905 and 1915, wood frame houses. And most of them were two bedrooms, some were one. And they all had lawns, every one of them. And there were no Asians, nor blacks. It was English, Irish, Dutch, German, Mr. Lutz, this German guy about five houses up. He stepped on a nail and got lockjaw and died. Healthcare wasn't the greatest. The Strikes, the Claytons, George Clayton drove a Borden's milk truck. There were no tankers then. You took empty cans out into the countryside. 5 gallon and 10 gallon cans. 10 gallons, I guess they were. Stainless galvanized, very shiny. Lids on them fit very tight, and he'd come back with fulls, having left the empties off as he picked up the fulls. And it was all manhandled, loaded on this big stake truck with wooden stake sides. It's called a stake truck. I didn't know anybody was in the union on the whole block. I never heard anyone say union. The first time I ever heard anyone say union was the L.A. Streetcar Railway. L.A. Railway had a strike, and it must have been in about 1932.
Did they arrest the red car?
No, this is the yellow car. This is the Metropolitan, not the Suburban. Red T.E. belonged to Huntington, SP Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And they went.
Were they unionized?
No, none of that was unionized. But it was an attempt, evidently, to unionize LA Railway. And I was in the sweet shop, Mr. Henderson's sweet shop. He made chocolates and the whole thing right then and there. And this man came in and was making a whole rationalization for having scabbed out loud to everybody. What are the guys going to do? Need a job and so on. And I couldn't really understand fully what he was talking about. But it impressed me, and what he said was said with such drama that I remembered it. And then after the fact, in years to come, I understood what he was talking about after. Only because it was so dramatic that I would remember it vividly. The block did finally develop some poor in the Dust Bowl period. People from Oklahoma and Texas and Arkansas began to show up. And the kid Raymond that I was my age, I started playing with him regularly. He didn't know what a toilet was. He'd never seen toilet paper, and that impressed me. And there was another little boy named Johnny, and he had a runny nose at all times, and this black overcoat he wore was just laced with mucus from his nose. And he was starving.
What is it?
He once saw a rotten banana I had, and an overripe banana. I didn't want it. He practically ate peel and all. Said, banana's good for bad colds. Kid was in a bad way.
Did his family rent a house?
At the bottom of the block. Eventually, those houses were all taken by Armenians.
Mm-hmm. What did his father do for him?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Were there more than one of these? Do you call these people Okies?
Yeah, Okies, Arkies, Dust Bowl people.
And did you ever go to their house? Was there more than one family living in their house?
No, I don't recall them being more than one family. These are small houses, but there are a lot of children.
On your block, what sort of work did people do? Were there factories in that area?
Oh, yeah, the Continental Can was a block and a half away. And a big Continental Can factory. But Mr. Bradley, two doors up, worked for the telephone company all his life. Mr. Keller worked for the gas company all his life. And they were hourly guys. They weren't supervision. But they were company stiffs. They were the guys who talked pro-company when they talked. I can recall it.
What about your Uncle George? What did he do?
George was the middle child. Right between my mother and Stan. And he was like, so with so many middle children, tended to be a little isolated. And a loner. And he was the one with sense of comedy and drama. And he was the one who really was a social catalyst to keep the extended family together. Because when he got us together, he had audience, and he would always start us all singing and dancing, and he'd be playing the ukulele or the guitar or the mandolin. And he had a lot of jobs throughout the worst of the early Depression, but he got on in the city park system as a civil servant. And he retired from that 30-some years later as park department, still mowing lawns, for a while, Point Fairman.
Wow.
He worked right at Point Fairman, mowing the lawns out there and clipping the hedges and all of that stuff. And he was the main one that would drill me. Get a job for the post office.
My father already told me the same thing.
You know what? Don't be a dummy like me. Get an education and have the kind of job where the golf clubs are in the back of the car.
Yeah.
And his son did that. My cousin Jack actually did that. He was really influenced by his father.
Yeah.
He became the head of a Pacific Finance Company, loan agency.
Yeah, right.
Jack did. And had golf clubs in the back of the car. And a little yacht.
Well, I have golf clubs in the back of my car right now. I never used it. Did you guys have a car?
Not until 1936. My mother worked for that rich woman right up to the war. Right through the worst of the Depression. And every week had a paycheck. And she bought, in 1936, she bought a 28 Chevrolet, and in 37, she bought a new Plymouth for
$700. For
$700? Yeah, brand new, right off the floor. Four-door sedan, black.
Do you remember the Depression, the images of the Depression? In L.A., did it affect people in the neighborhood?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You mentioned Uncle Stan drank a lot.
There was a lot of that. On our block, there was a family, and it hit them very hard. They had two children, and they were an Irish family, and the old man developed a nickname of Mooch. And I won't say his real name even, because he may have, you know, kin. But this was my uncle's, their daughter was my uncle's steady girlfriend for years, and they were very much in love. When she died calling for him. But she was taken away to Honolulu and became a prostitute in the depth of Depression. And returned within 10 years an old woman. I mean, really beat up. And she operated out of a bar at the head of our block, around the street. And there were more cases like that. But that symbolizes one of the things that really impressed our family and depressed our family. And there was a woman three doors up from us who was the mother of my Uncle George's best friend growing up. And she was she was whoring out of her own house and had her pimp right there living with her. And people thought, they acted like man and wife, but they weren't married. And no one stiffed her. Everybody loved her. And she had me to her house all the time, making cookies for me and everything.
And you knew her...
I didn't know until I was a teenager. I didn't know what was going on.
I didn't know what was going on.
I saw all these men coming and going, and it never occurred to me what this was all about. One of the startling things for me was at Whittier Boulevard, which was Highway 101. There were our market where we went, the Globe Market at Alma and Whittier was there on the corner. And I went up to the market on my bicycle, and I leaned my bicycle against the lamppost, and there was a man with a cap on walking out in the double park area where you walk when you're hitchhiking. And he had two shopping bags full, and he had sandwich boards on them. And the sandwich board said, "Pick me up or I'll vote for Hoover." So that tells you the time it was. It was late 31, 1931. I was 10 years old. That impressed me. The other thing that impressed me was the home relief. There was a place on Whittier Boulevard at about Rowan or Gage Street, I think it was Rowan, or Townsend Street in Whittier Boulevard, where you could go if you had and bring your own shopping bags, and they would fill two shopping bags with cauliflower, cabbage, and some canned goods, relief beef with the NRA blue and white label on it, not to be resold.
Mm-hmm. This, is this in,
1932,
33?
33.
Yeah, it must be 33. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And they got fresh groceries and some canned goods. Mm-hmm. And the people in those lines always impressed me. And my family would never go there, but they didn't have to. My mother was working.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were, because of that job with this rich woman, the LeBarons, we were not made to do that.
Did your neighborhood vote for Franklin Roosevelt, or did it?
I don't know. Our neighborhood did go in some part for Upton Sinclair,
mm-hmm.
Epic,
mm-hmm.
In Poverty in California.
So you remember that? You remember his campaign?
In 34, yeah. They had kind of roughed my mother up. She went to the streetcar and they cornered her and badgered her and so on, and it kind of scared her. And I'm sure she must have voted against him, mm-hmm. because of that incident. And she was a very timid person and things like this. But the people on the block, a good portion of them, had Epic signs in their windows and stickers on their cars.
But your mother wasn't a real political...
Not at all.
Was Stan or George political?
Not at all. Not that I ever saw any evidence of. And they were racist guys.
Mm-hmm.
In their talk and the way they felt this kind of resentment, workforce resentment, to all racial minorities.
What was your attitude when you were young? Do you remember having times when you came?
I came to my Uncle Stan one night with a newspaper. There was a famine in India, and it said something, hundreds of thousands of people dead from starvation and so on, and I came to him with this newspaper and said, "Look at this." And he said, "What difference does it make? They're all niggers anyway." And I never went to him again. And I knew out of the innocence of childhood that that was wrong. And I think it was my awakening, though, that there was such a thing as kind of the God racism among people and the feelings they had. It didn't mean that I stopped loving him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it meant that there was a reservation between he and I.
Well, at least as far as that.
George, the same thing.
Well, tell me, what school did you go to? What grammar school did you go to?
I went to Eastman Street School. That was about 6 blocks away. And I went to Stevenson Junior High, which was on Whittier, practically on, it was on Percy in Indiana, which is about 4 blocks away.
Were the students in your classes all basically from the same Western European background?
Early in grammar school, yes. But before I left the 6th grade, already I would say